this, we should either read books by knowledgeable authors or seek instruction from qualified masters. What is an empowerment? Why are some teachings secret? The purpose of empowerment, initiation, is to ripen one's mind stream for the tantric practice by making a connection with a deity who is a manifestation of the omniscient minds. This depends on having a virtuous motivation, taking the vows and commitments the empowerment entails, and meditating during the empowerment ceremony. Thus, one does not receive empowerment merely by being present in the room where an empowerment is taking place. People may be present when an empowerment is offered, but if they do not take the vows and commitments at the appropriate times in the ceremony, or meditate and visualize as the master instructs, they have not received the empowerment. Empowerment is not about having a vase placed on one's head, drinking blessed water, or tying a consecrated string around one's arm. After empowerment, sincere practitioners seek instructions on how to do the practice. These instructions are not given before the empowerment because the students' minds are not yet prepared to practice them. For this reason, they are secret. It's not that the Buddha was miserly and didn't want to share the teachings, nor is tantric practice a membership to an exclusive club that jealously guards its secrets. Rather, tantric instruction is given only to people who have received empowerment to ensure that those engaging in the practice have been properly prepared. Otherwise, someone might misunderstand the symbolism employed in the tantra, or engage in advanced and complex practices without proper preparation and instruction. At what point does someone take a tantric empowerment? Before entering the Vajrayana, one must be well-trained in the determination to be free from cyclic existence, the altruistic intention, and the wisdom realizing the emptiness of inherent existence. One then takes an empowerment, initiation, from a qualified tantric master, and follows the vows and commitments taken at the time of empowerment. On this basis, one receives instructions and practices the Vajrayana meditations. Initiations are not ends in themselves. They are a gateway into further practice. Thus, sincere students take empowerments because they want to practice the teachings afterward. Why are empowerments given so openly to newcomers if people need a firm foundation in general Buddhist practices to practice Tantra effectively? Many lamas, Tibetan spiritual masters, believe that although people may not be fully prepared to do the Vajrayana practice, positive imprints are placed on their mind streams by taking empowerments and thus making a karmic connection to the practice. However, since taking tantric empowerments often involves taking vows and commitments and promising to do a certain meditation practice daily, it's wise for people to consider carefully before rushing into these practices. When Dharma centers announce an empowerment, they should also tell people which vows and commitments are involved and which practices must be done afterward. Also, people should examine the qualities of a spiritual master to make sure that he or she is qualified, and that they want to form a teacher-student relationship with that person. Going slowly and developing one's Dharma practice gradually is best, rather than jumping into high practices thinking, this is the one and only opportunity. Also, one should avoid running here and there, taking every empowerment that is offered. It's better to take fewer empowerments but to practice them well, than to collect empowerments but practice very little. Are there different types of empowerments? Yes. In Tibetan, they fall into two main categories, janang and wang. A janang is like a blessing or permission to do the practice, while a wang entails actually imagining ourselves entering into the mandala of a deity. In English, both these terms are often translated as initiation or empowerment, which is confusing. If you are unsure, ask the spiritual master giving it which it is. In addition, the practice of each Buddha figure or deity has its own empowerment. Receiving empowerment into one practice does not enable us to do the practice of another deity. We must receive that deity's specific empowerment. Why is the Kalachakra empowerment given publicly to a large number of people, many of whom may not even be Buddhists? This empowerment is unique because the Kalachakra practice speaks about the welfare of the entire society, and it was first given centuries ago in order to unify and bring peace in a certain society. Thus, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama gives this empowerment, he offers non-Buddhists and Buddhists who are not yet ready to take an empowerment the option of attending the ceremony as a neutral observer, without taking the empowerment. This is done only in the case of this empowerment. At other times, we are not permitted to be a tourist in an empowerment, simply watching the proceedings. What does the imagery in tantric art mean? Vajrayana deals with transformation, and therefore symbolism is widely used. All the tantric deities are manifestations of fully enlightened, compassionate Buddhas. Yet the appearance of some of these deities is ferocious or desirous. The sexual imagery isn't to be taken literally, according to worldly appearances. In Vajrayana, the depiction of deities in sexual union represents the union of method and wisdom, the two aspects of the path needed to attain enlightenment. Ferocious-looking deities are not monsters who threaten us. Their wrath is directed toward ignorance and selfishness, which are our real enemies. This imagery, when properly understood, shows how desire and anger can be transformed and thereby subdued. It has deep meaning, far beyond ordinary lust and anger. One should avoid misinterpreting it. What are mandalas? There are many types of mandalas. In tantric practice, they are the mansions and environments of the various Buddhist deities. These mandalas, which are actually three-dimensional, are often drawn like blueprints on a two-dimensional surface with sand or paint. Once we have received the appropriate empowerment, we may visualize the three-dimensional mandala of a deity as part of a meditation. Doing this practice entails receiving instructions from our spiritual master. Mandala can also refer to the world and environment we live in. Thus, when we offer the mandala when requesting teachings, we visualize our universe and everything beautiful in it, and offer this to our spiritual masters while requesting them to guide, instruct, and inspire us. Who are Dakas and Dakinis? They are tantric practitioners who aid others on the path. We generally visualize them in transcendental forms, but in some cases they may appear as ordinary people. Who are the Dharma protectors? Dharma protectors are found in most Buddhist traditions, not just the Vajrayana. These are beings who have promised to help safeguard the existence of the Dharma in our world and to protect the people who practice it. They are generally fierce in appearance, but their wrath is directed toward the ignorance producing the misunderstandings, disharmony, and degeneration that destroy the Dharma. Some Dharma protectors are transworldly. That is, they are manifestations of Buddhas, or they are Arya Bodhisattvas, who have direct perception of emptiness. Others are beings within cyclic existence who have promised the Buddhas that they would protect the Dharma. While the transworldly Dharma protectors have directly realized emptiness, the worldly ones have not. Thus, the latter are not considered part of the three jewels of refuge. What are pujas? Puja is a Sanskrit word meaning offering. Thus, pujas are offering ceremonies that generally involve imagining a manifestation of the Buddha and making various offerings. Offerings are not made to win the deity's favor, as enlightened beings are already compassionate towards all impartially. Rather, they enable us to develop a mind that delights in giving and to create positive potential, good karma, from offering to enlightened beings. Sog is a Tibetan word meaning assembly and is a specific type of offering made to the root and lineage gurus, meditational deities, three jewels, Dakas and Dakinis, and Dharma protectors. Vajrayana seems to be full of colorful and elaborate rituals. Where is the meditation? Public Vajrayana ceremonies may appear very ritualistic, but the rituals are not ends in themselves. They are guided meditations in which practitioners try to generate the meanings of the prayers in their minds. When these same practices are done privately, practitioners can shorten the recitations and pause for longer periods to practice concentration and insight meditation, or to meditate on loving-kindness. Chapter 12. Steps Along the Path. What is an arhat? Arahat. What is nirvana? Nibbana. An arhat is someone who has eliminated ignorance, disturbing attitudes, and negative emotions, anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, etc., from his or her mind forever. In addition, he or she has purified all karma that could cause rebirth in cyclic existence, samsara. An arhat abides in a state of peace, which is called nirvana, or liberation, and is beyond all unsatisfactory experiences and confusion. What is bodhi, or enlightenment? In addition to eliminating ignorance, disturbing attitudes, and contaminated actions, karma, from their minds, Buddhas have also eliminated the subtle stains of these defilements and have fully developed the altruistic intention that cherishes others more than self. Thus, Buddhas have attained full enlightenment, the state in which all defilements have been purified and all good qualities developed. What is a bodhisattva? A bodhisattva is someone who spontaneously and continuously has the wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings. By practicing the path, such a person will attain the state of Buddhahood. Different levels of bodhisattvas exist, according to their level of realization. Some are not yet free from cyclic existence, while others are. The latter can then voluntarily continue to take birth in the world by the power of their compassion to help others. Buddhas can do this as well. Do bodhisattvas give up attaining enlightenment and stay in this world to help others? Some scriptures say that bodhisattvas vow to stay in cyclic existence and not attain enlightenment until all beings have been liberated from cyclic existence. This means that bodhisattvas' compassion for sentient beings is so strong that if it were beneficial, they would happily sacrifice their own liberation for that of others. However, bodhisattvas are also practical and realize that to help others most effectively, they need to become Buddhas themselves, because only Buddhas have the full compassion, wisdom, and skill needed to fully benefit others. Thus, bodhisattvas seek to attain full enlightenment, but when they do, they don't remain in a solitary, blissful state and forget about others. They manifest in forms to guide others skillfully. What is an Arya? A superior or noble one. This is a person who has direct realization of emptiness. Such a realization occurs before one becomes an arhat or Buddha. With an Arya's wisdom realizing emptiness, one eliminates ignorance, disturbing attitudes, contaminated karma, and their stains, thereby attaining liberation and enlightenment. Chapter 13. Working with Emotions. What role do emotions play in Buddhist practice? Does the Buddha have emotions? Some emotions are realistic and constructive. Others aren't. Thus, some are to be cultivated on the path, and others abandoned. The Buddha taught various antidotes to counteract negative emotions, such as anger, attachment, jealousy, and pride. He also taught techniques to cultivate positive emotions, such as love and compassion. According to Buddhism, love is the wish for all others to have happiness and its causes, and compassion is the wish for them to be free of all unsatisfactory conditions and their causes. Such love and compassion are extended equally to all beings, and the Buddha taught a step-by-step method for developing them. Are all desires bad? What about the desire to attain nirvana or enlightenment? This confusion occurs because sometimes the English word desire is used to translate two different Buddhist concepts. In English, desire is of different types. The desire that is problematic exaggerates the good qualities of an object, person, place, or idea and clings to it. Such desire is a form of attachment. An example is being very emotionally dependent on someone and clinging to him or her. When we look with a more balanced attitude, we see that the other person isn't nearly as fantastic as our attachment led us to believe. On the other hand, the desire that spurs us to prepare for future lives or to attain nirvana or enlightenment is completely different. Here we realize that better states of being are possible and develop a realistic aspiration to achieve them. No misconceptions are involved, nor is there clinging to the desired result. Wouldn't life be boring without attachment? No. In fact, it's attachment that makes us restless and prevents us from enjoying things. For example, suppose we're attached to chocolate cake. Even while we're eating it, we're not tasting it and enjoying it completely. We're usually either criticizing ourselves for eating something fattening, comparing the taste of this chocolate cake to other cakes we've eaten in the past, or planning how to get another piece. In any case, we're not really experiencing the chocolate cake in the present. On the other hand, without attachment, we can think clearly about whether we want to eat the cake, and if we decide to, we can eat it peacefully, tasting and enjoying every bite without craving for more or being dissatisfied because it isn't as good as we expected. As we diminish our attachment, life becomes more interesting because we're able to open up to what's happening in each moment. For example, rather than wishing we were with the people to whom we're attached, we'll appreciate being with whomever we're spending time with at present. Instead of being attached to our physical appearance and consequently feeling constant dissatisfaction with how we look, we'll simply do what's needed to keep our body healthy and clean, and we'll be satisfied with how we look. How can we pursue a career without attachment to reputation and wealth? How can we do business and also be ethical? If we deeply contemplate the transient and unpredictable nature of wealth, reputation, and worldly success, the belief that they'll bring us lasting happiness will fade. Then we can start to change our motivation for working. We can look at our work as service to society and as an opportunity to learn more about ourselves by interacting with others. Our work will thus become an occasion to practice the teachings that we meditate on. In this way, patience and cherishing others will not be traits we cultivate only in meditation, but qualities we develop in daily life. If we diminish our attachment, living ethically will be easier. As our priorities change, we will be fair in our business dealings and will not backbite to climb the corporate ladder. Although some people think being unethical is necessary to succeed in business, one successful business executive told me that the opposite is the case. When we deal fairly with clients, they trust us, continue to do business with us, and bring in new customers. When we treat our colleagues respectfully, they generally reciprocate, and we will avoid becoming entangled in office politics. Should others mistreat us, we can work on practicing tolerance and developing better communication skills. Our feeling of being successful human beings will not depend on money and fame. We'll feel better about ourselves and have less guilt because we live ethically. That will actually save money because we will not need to go to a psychiatrist for our emotional problems or a lawyer for our legal ones. How can we deal with fear? Fear is closely related to attachment. The more attached we are to someone or something, the more we fear not having it or being separated from it. For example, if we're very attached to and emotionally dependent on a particular person, we fear the relationship will end. If we're attached to money and financial security, we are anxious about not having enough. If we're attached to our image, we fear looking stupid in front of others. On one hand, it's normal to have such concerns because we've been raised to be attached to these things. On the other hand, clinging makes us fearful and anxious. The solution isn't to abandon our friends' money and reputation, but to let go of the attachment to them. Then we can enjoy them free from fear. Meditating on impermanence and seeing the transient nature of things helps us to let go of attachment and to set our priorities wisely. Imagining getting all the things we are attached to and then asking ourselves, "Now am I forever happy?" enables us to stop obsessing about the things and people we are attached to. As we let go of the attachment, our fear of not having or of losing these objects of attachment will naturally dissipate. Can one be attached to Buddhism? What should we do if someone attacks our beliefs and criticizes the Dharma? Each situation must be regarded individually. In general, if we feel they are criticizing my beliefs, they think I am stupid for believing that, we are clinging to our beliefs because we think these beliefs are good because they are mine. If someone criticizes them, they are criticizing me. Such an attitude isn't very productive and will be more peaceful if we abandon it. We are not our beliefs. If others disagree with our beliefs, it does not mean we are stupid. Being open to what others say is useful. Let's not be attached to the name and label of our religion. We are seeking truth and happiness, not promotion of a religion because it happens to be ours. In addition, questioning the teachings is reasonable. The Buddha himself said we should check his teachings and not just believe in them blindly. On the other hand, we should not automatically agree with everything someone else says. We should not abandon our beliefs and adopt theirs indiscriminately. If someone asks a question we cannot answer, it doesn't mean the Buddha's teachings are wrong. It simply means we don't know the answer and need to learn and contemplate more. We can then take the question to knowledgeable Buddhists and think about their answers. When others question our beliefs, they are actually helping us deepen our understanding of the Buddha's teachings by showing us what we do not yet understand. This inspires us to study the Dharma and reflect on its meaning. We needn't defend our beliefs to someone else. If people ask questions with sincere interest and are open-minded and interested in a real exchange of views, talking with them can be mutually enriching. However, if people really don't want a response and just want to antagonize or confuse us, then dialogue is impossible. There is no need to feel defensive in front of such people. We don't have to prove anything to them. Even if we were to give them logical answers, they would not listen because they are involved with their own preconceptions. Without being rude, we can be quite firm and end the conversation. What can we do about stress? Stress can be caused by a number of factors, some external and some internal. When we are stressed because there's not enough time and we feel pressured, it's helpful to think about our priorities and decide what things are most important in our lives. Then we can choose to do those things and put the others on the back burner. When we're stressed because we don't have the ability to do something that's expected of us, we need to accept our limitations. We aren't failures because we lack certain abilities. We need to communicate honestly with the people who hold such expectations of us. When we're stressed due to illness or sudden changes in our living situation, it's helpful to reflect on impermanence, that everything in our world will change. Then we can adapt to the change rather than fight it. Our stress is often due to not accepting the reality of a situation. We want it to be different, or we want ourselves or others to be different. However, what is happening at the moment is what exists. Instead of rejecting the situation, which causes us more anxiety, we can accept it and work with it. Accepting whatever is happening isn't being fatalistic, it's being realistic. Having accepted the reality of the situation for what it presently is, we can still try to improve it in the future while remaining realistic about what is possible. Calming the mind through breathing meditation counteracts stress. So does meditating on patience and compassion. Purification meditation is helpful as well. For this reason, daily meditation is recommended to prevent and counteract stress. Many people suffer from guilt and self-blame. What can be done about this? Whether we made an error intentionally or not, guilt and self-hatred are inappropriate. We need to clearly examine what we are responsible for, what we have power over, and what we are not. Guilt often comes from considering ourselves responsible for something we have no power over. For example, if we find ourselves in a dangerous situation through our own carelessness, we are responsible for our being there. However, if someone physically or sexually abuses us, we are not responsible for this. It's the other's action, not our own. Abused children or rape victims are not responsible for their own abuse or rape. There is no need to feel guilty or blame oneself for what happened. If we deliberately cause another harm, for example, by intentionally causing discord in our workplace, the pain that results is our doing. However, if we act with good intentions, yet another experiences pain from our actions, That is not our responsibility. For example, if, with a kind heart, we try to give people feedback on their actions and they get upset, that is not our responsibility. But if we fail to take care in how we express ourselves, we are responsible for our miscommunication and should attempt to correct it. When we act negatively due to our own confusion and disturbing attitudes, we should not feel guilty and blame ourselves. Instead, we should try to remedy the situation as best we can, and also do purification practices to counteract the negative karmic imprint on our mind stream. From the Buddhist viewpoint, guilt is a disturbing attitude. It does not see the situation clearly and is a form of self-centeredness. Emotionally beating up on ourselves does not alter the past or develop our potential. It only immobilizes us and makes us spiral downward into self-preoccupation. On the other hand, if we have confidence in our ability to improve because we know we have the potential to become fully enlightened, we will regret our mistakes and act positively in order to remedy the harmful effects of our actions. Can meditation solve our emotional problems? That depends on us, our teacher, and our meditation practice. In some cases, it can. In others, it's more effective if people seek help from a therapist and use meditation as an adjunct. How are Buddhism and therapy similar? How are they different? Both seek to understand the functioning of the human mind. Both offer techniques to foster happiness and well-being through generating more constructive mental states. Both transmit these techniques to others through experienced guides. And both are composed of various sub-schools with slightly different approaches and emphases. However, the end goals of therapy and Buddhism differ. Therapy seeks to help people be happy in this life, whereas Buddhism is concerned with their happiness in future lives and their lasting happiness through attaining liberation. Therapy doesn't regard ignorance, anger, and attachment as the root causes of difficulties, and therefore as attitudes to be abandoned completely. Therapists often encourage people to be angry at those who have harmed them and to find more effective ways to obtain the things they're attached to. Buddhism, on the other hand, seeks to uproot anger, attachment, and selfishness from the mind altogether. There are some differences in the methods employed in therapy and in Buddhism. Many therapies involve recollecting past traumatic experiences and reprocessing them in the present. However, Buddhism encourages students to identify general behavior patterns and apply antidotes to them. Remembering specific childhood experiences and reliving them is not seen as important. Some therapies are concerned with the contents of the client's dreams, whereas Buddhism generally is not. Meditators are encouraged to identify dreams as dreams, and to use the illusory nature of dreams as an analogy to how things appear to exist from their own side, while, in fact, they do not. The roles of spiritual masters and therapists differ as well. Therapy takes place individually or in a small group where people discuss their specific problems with the therapist. Spiritual teachers usually instruct larger groups, and the students are responsible for practicing what they are taught on their own. Of course, if students need individual counseling or have questions about Dharma practice, spiritual mentors are happy to see them. Spiritual mentors are interested in how their students' meditation is progressing and in how well they are integrating the Dharma into their daily lives. Transference may occur both in one's relationship with a therapist and with a spiritual mentor. Depending on the awareness and level of practice of the therapist or teacher, counter-transference may also occur. Psychology and Buddhism can learn a lot from each other, and interest in this dialogue is increasing. More research and discussion in this area are needed. What is the Buddhist position regarding antidepressants and other medications that are taken for mental unhappiness? Each case must be examined separately, and the following are general guidelines. Depression is often caused by a combination of a chemical imbalance in the brain and psychological difficulties. When people are severely depressed, medications can enable them to feel well enough to begin to look at the psychological components of their depression. There is no stigma attached to taking antidepressants when they are needed to counteract a chemical imbalance in the brain, or to help someone feel well enough to function in daily life. However, taking antidepressants in order to avoid looking at the psychological aspects of the depression is not helpful. Similarly, taking antidepressants for mild depression, instead of examining and changing other factors contributing to the depression, such as physical health, lack of exercise, poor diet, stressful factors in life, incorrect ways of interpreting events, and so on, is not recommended. Chapter 14. Dharma in Daily Life. How can we live as Buddhists in modern society when its values and activities are so different from those we try to cultivate in our practice? The more we think about the Buddhist teachings and become confident in their validity, the easier practice will become. For example, the more we examine our own experience and recognize the disadvantages of being attached to material possessions, the less power advertising will have over our minds. As we see the disadvantages of unethical actions, we won't get drawn into others' unwholesome schemes. Time and effort are necessary to integrate the Buddha's teachings in our minds. But as we do it, we will slowly progress. Let's say we've decided to avoid taking intoxicants, and our colleagues ask us to have a drink after work. We shouldn't launch into a harangue against drinking, but quietly order juice instead. We may initially feel embarrassed and fear ridicule, but this is due to our attachment to reputation. If we are clear about what we want and don't want to do, why be concerned with others' opinions? It could be that the others drink because they feel we expect them to, and they may be relieved when we don't. Even if they want to drink, a person who doesn't could be a good example to them. The most important qualities necessary to live harmoniously with others are friendliness and genuine concern for others. The more we develop these internal qualities, the more they will automatically be reflected in our behavior and speech. Other people relate to and respect these qualities more than our sharing their views about such topics as intoxicants, the death penalty, and TV shows. If we are friendly, happy, and compassionate people, we will get along with others well. How do we tell our family and friends who aren't Buddhist about our interest in the Dharma? At the beginning of our practice, we tend not to be sure of ourselves or very confident in the Dharma, so we are very sensitive to others' comments about what we are doing. As we gradually relax into the practice, we'll find it easier to talk with our family, friends, and colleagues about Buddhism. Of course, we should not become preachers, using a lot of Buddhist jargon to impress others. Rather, we should answer people's questions simply, responding in a way that will make sense to them. There are many ways to talk about Buddhism without using Dharma words. After all, Buddhism is basically a common-sense approach to life. When our friends talk to us about their problems, we can discuss the antidotes to anger, jealousy, or clinging attachment in a simple way without even using the word Buddhism. Giving people more information than they want is not skillful. Therefore, we should listen carefully to someone's question and respond to it accurately without going on and on about unrelated or complicated topics that may interest us, but not the other person. When talking with people of other religions, we can discuss the points that Buddhism has in common with their faith. Every religion values ethics, love, and compassion, so it's skillful to speak about these when first explaining Buddhism. Don't start off by talking about rebirth, karma, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and other unfamiliar words and concepts. Also, we can emphasize that according to Buddhism, the diversity of religions in the world is good because that gives people the opportunity to find a philosophy and practice that suits them. Everyone doesn't need to become a Buddhist. Speaking in this way makes people of other faiths relax because they know we respect their beliefs and will not try to convert them. Those who are married may want to invite their spouse and children to meet their teachers and Dharma friends, or to visit their Dharma center if they're interested. Some people neglect their families because they've become excited about helping all sentient beings and becoming a Buddha. They practice patience with everyone but their spouse and children, and expect the rest of the family to do all the household chores while they meditate. This isn't very skillful. While Dharma practitioners want to lessen their clinging attachment to their families, they should not neglect them. Dharma involves generating genuine love and compassion for people we're in daily contact with, not just for sentient beings universes away whom we never see. What can we do if our family and friends are not supportive or are even resentful of our interest in Buddhism? First, accept that they feel that way and don't get angry about it. Being irritated at them will only increase the tension. On the other hand, we need not give up our beliefs or our practice due to family pressure. While flaunting our practice with a rebellious attitude is unwise, we need not hide it out of fear either. We can adapt to the external situation while keeping our practice alive and firm internally. For example, if our family cannot relate to a shrine with pictures of the Buddha, we can keep the pictures in our Dharma books and take them out when we meditate. In many cases, our actions will convince others of the value of our Dharma practice. When our colleagues notice that we're more patient and tolerant, they will be curious about what we've done to bring about this change. If we help to clean the house and take out the garbage when visiting our parents, they may be very impressed, thinking, "This is the first time in 40 years my son has helped around the house. Buddhism is great." The non-Buddhist wife of one of my students has supported and encouraged her husband for years to attend our annual 9-day retreat. Why? Because every time he returns from retreat, he is calmer, communicates better, and is much more loving to his family. Predicting which of our friends and family will be interested in the Dharma is difficult. We may assume a very dear friend will be interested, but he is not. Similarly, we may assume that a relative will not want to discuss Buddhist ideas only to discover that she is receptive. Therefore, while having our own agenda often alienates people, going along with our friends' level of interest and receptivity opens the door to good discussions. How do we establish a daily meditation practice? And what should it include? Meditate in a clean, quiet place in your home, away from the telephone and computer. You can set up a small shrine there if you wish. Meditating at approximately the same time each day gets you into a good rhythm. The mind is fresh in the morning, and many people find it easier to meditate then, before the activities of the day have begun. Other people prefer to meditate in the evenings. Make the meditation sessions a comfortable length, neither too short nor too long. You could start out with 15 minutes and gradually extend it as you're able to sit longer. Follow the instructions of your spiritual teacher on how to structure the sessions. You may start out with a few prayers to take refuge and set a good motivation for meditation. Then you could do some breathing meditation and, depending on your tradition, another type of meditation as well. Our meditation time is quiet time alone when we can digest our experiences, look at our lives, cultivate our good qualities, and enjoy our own company, and that of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas too. Must we go to the mountains and meditate to practice Dharma? Not at all. Some people can happily remain in solitude and develop high realizations through meditation. But for a long retreat to be successful, we need to have accumulated great positive potential and to have a good foundation in the basic Dharma practices. These prerequisites can be gathered while living and practicing in society. In that way, we integrate Dharma into our lives and simultaneously offer direct service to society. On the other hand, if we go to live in isolation with an emotional dream of becoming a great meditator, when in fact we are unable to confront our dissatisfied mind, we'll return confused and unhappy. It's wiser to practice in a way that corresponds to our present mental state and ability. How can we integrate Buddhism into our daily lives? How do we balance work and spiritual practice? When you wake up in the morning, try to make your first thought, "Today I don't want to harm anyone. I'm going to help others as much as possible. May all my actions be directed toward the long-term goal of becoming a Buddha to benefit others." After you get up, meditate for a while to get in touch with your inner calm, to learn about yourself, and to set a good motivation for the day. During the day, be mindful of your feelings, thoughts, words, and actions. When you notice negative emotions or harmful behavior arising in yourself, apply the antidotes taught by the Buddha. For example, to counteract attachment, reflect on impermanence. And to subdue anger, contemplate patience, love, and the kindness of others. Of course, the more we have meditated on these previously, the easier it will be to recall and use them at the moment. In the middle of a busy day, stop, breathe, and get centered again before going on. Although this takes only a minute, it's sometimes hard to get ourselves to pause when we're on automatic pilot. Pausing is a good habit to develop. Instead of answering the phone right away, first think, may I speak kindly and benefit the person on the line? And then pick up the phone. When we sit down at our desk, we can breathe quietly for a few seconds and then begin work. When we're stopped at a light or stuck in traffic, we can look around and think, all these people around me want to be happy and to avoid problems just as I do. Because we live in an interdependent society, I receive benefit from the different jobs these people do, even though I don't know them personally. It's also very helpful to think like this when someone cuts us off. We can also have Dharma-related reminders such as compassion, mindfulness, or Om Mani Padme Hum screensavers on our computer. In the evening, take a little time to review the day's events, purify any harmful attitudes or behaviors, rejoice in the changes and positive attitudes you're developing, and dedicate all the positive potential for the enlightenment of all. We often expect fast food enlightenment, not wanting to expend much time or energy to gain it. Unfortunately, things don't work that way. Profound change occurs gradually. We need to rejoice at our own and others' development instead of being dissatisfied with what we haven't done. What can we do if our practice weakens due to the influence of the external environment, and controlling our attachment becomes difficult? Daily meditation practice is an excellent remedy. In the morning, sit quietly and spend some time remembering the disadvantages of attachment, recalling impermanence and death, and generating loving kindness toward others. During the day, be aware of what you think, say, and do. If we are strongly attached to something, it's best, as beginners, to keep some distance from it. Just as a compulsive eater on a diet has difficulty going to a dinner party and watching everyone else eat, so too we will find it difficult to be near objects of attachment and remain unaffected. As our internal practice gets stronger and we are less drawn to superficial glitter, we can again be with those objects and people with a peaceful mind. If our friends encourage us to go places or do things that make our previous habitual attachment, anger, or jealousy arise, we may suggest an alternative activity or decline the invitation. If we are sincere in our practice, we will naturally make new friends with a similar interest in Dharma, and they will encourage us to develop in a positive direction. Chapter 15. Social Activism and Ethical Issues. What is the Buddhist attitude toward social welfare projects? They are necessary and very good. As Buddhists, we try to develop love and compassion for others on a mental level, but this must be expressed in action as well. His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, has often commented that Buddhists can learn from the Christian example of active compassion through involvement in community welfare projects. Establishing schools, hospitals, hospices, counseling services, and food services for the needy directly benefits others. However, while engaging in this work, we must guard against partisanship, pride, and anger. Both our attitude and our actions must be directed toward benefiting others. People have different dispositions and talents, and thus will practice the Dharma in various ways. Some will focus on study and teaching, others on work to benefit society, and others on meditation. Although not all Buddhists are inclined toward socially engaged projects, those who are can practice the Dharma in that context. Does Buddhism condone social activism? As with many questions, the answer begins with, it depends. Depending upon our motivation and on the kind of changes we advocate and the methods we use, social activism may be helpful or harmful. Advocating policies or methods that run counter to the general Buddhist principles of nonviolence and tolerance is harmful. Even if we favor beneficial policies, if our motivation is askew, the long-term results will not be good. For example, an attitude of moral indignation that sees others in society as inept, manipulative, and selfish is scarcely a constructive motivation with which to engage in social action. If we frame a situation in terms of us versus them and claim our side is right because we care for the general welfare of society while theirs is wrong, then our motivation is almost identical to theirs. Such an attitude leads us to despise the other side. And again, we are caught in the cycle of attachment to what is close to the self and hatred for what is opposed. Social and political problems are neither clear-cut nor easily solved. Long-term vision and great effort are necessary. Although we know this intellectually, our words and actions sometimes indicate that we seek swift and simple solutions. We must try to develop compassion for all parties involved in a conflict, because each of them wishes to be happy and to avoid problems. For example, if we regard loggers as destroyers of the environment and are concerned only with stopping their harmful activities, our outlook is limited. Loggers want happiness just as we do. They also have families to support. We must value their concerns and seek solutions that contain alternative means for them to earn a living. Does the belief in future lives justify complacency in regards to social injustice? Does the law of karma indicate that we are to condone oppression? Does the wish for nirvana entail ignoring the ills of this world and seeking only the bliss of liberation? No to all three questions. People who do not have a good understanding of Buddhism may generate misconceptions such as, since rebirth exists, the poor will get another chance to be better off. Therefore, I don't need to help them now. The oppressed must have created negative karma to experience such a result, and I'd be interfering with their karma if I tried to remedy their plight. Suffering is inherent to cyclic existence. There's nothing that can be done, so I'll concern myself only with my spiritual practice and disregard the world's ills. Such ideas reflect an incorrect understanding of karma and nirvana. Love and compassion for others are basic Buddhist principles, and acting according to them leads to liberation. The suffering in the world is due to karma, but we can still help stop or limit it. Although lasting happiness in cyclic existence isn't possible, we must still try to lessen gross suffering and bring relative happiness. In fact, involvement in social action could be a means to lead others in the Dharma path. People certainly cannot meditate if they're hungry. Working to give them food stops